So Sudhadi just reminded me, and thanks to her, that the story about Amal Kiran reading the article in the newspaper, that was a nice story. It was not something written against Sri Aurobindo. But there is another story which was in a French magazine, Le Monde, where things were written against the ashram with various pictures. But reading that, many persons came because they got interested this way. What struck me as a flash just now when I read that, that perhaps it was the debt the Asura paid in some way to the divine. The mother has spoken of course, referred to that, that how some people, it's a debt they pay to the divine in this way, that they do things or write things which are not good, not right. And yet the divine uses it for his own purposes. They didn't intend it like that. They wanted something else. But results that come out are totally contrary. Now that is because in this world there is a divine guidance. And he turns even the worst for the good. It's not because of the original intent. But that's what we see even in karma. That because there is a divine guidance in the world, every event, every circumstance eventually turns to help us in the evolutionary journey. So we were at that, and here only an aspect of karma is being revealed to us. There are many places, mainly in book 6, that Sri Aurobindo describes the deeper and inner aspects of karma. But outwardly, one thing he tells us, that next time something happens, don't complain to God. Because that is the minimum take home point. And that Narada also reveals in book 6, that man, you have called upon yourself your destiny. And actually, as I said, from a purely philosophical standpoint, because many people think that Indian thought is very fatalistic. No. It is not fatalistic at all. It is empowering. Because if I am responsible for something, I can undo it. That's why the law of karma is not inexorable. It can be altered, modified, mitigated, annulled if we can touch something deeper within us. And that's what we read just before stopping in issue, that in the second canto, the issue, that there is something in us, like the self with a capital S, the Atman, and that can completely annul or cancel. And of course, the mother reminds us there is something still greater than the self, the grace that can completely annul karma. So essentially, karma then becomes a goad for the spirit to discover the inner self. It becomes a means to push us through that one door through which alone we can become freed from all these nightmares and daymares, all the good and bad, pleasant and painful scenes that are woven in front of us. We try this means, that means, but eventually, like Draupadi, we realize that it is not Bhishma the great, or Drona the mighty, or Dhritarashtra the blind emperor, or even her five great husbands, mighty like the gods, or even Dhrushtadyumna, her own brother, was born of Yagna. None of them can save her. She tries all these means and methods. Eventually, we have to discover that only the divine, he alone can save. So karma becomes very amazingly an evolutionary machinery. It helps us to grow, and in our own unique way, along our own lines. But to our outer vision, it all seems mechanical. A prescient architect of fate and chance. So the one who has built, it's wonderful. It's, you know, we children like to play snake and ladder. And there is its origin. There is an Indian version of it. It was displayed in the Sanskrit exhibition. It's Gyaneshwar's snake and ladder Ludo. It's very amazing. So if you do certain deeds, you climb up, and certain other deeds, you come down. So it's, but the best part of that thing is, it doesn't complete with 100. You keep moving around the cycle. But there is a point in the center. It's just like the mother's vision of circuitous movement and a straight path. So if you touch that, then you can arrive at the full culmination of that game. It's a very beautiful game. And I was almost in a mind to buy it, but one had to buy all the six games. So all the six games, the cost was prohibitive, but it was very nice to have those games for children. So the builder of fate and chance, the architect, is prescient. He knows things. He's an all-knowing guide. And it appears as fate and chance because we do not know the lines of forces that act behind. If we know it, it's no more fate and chance, but a perfectly logical sequence of things. The meaning knows and who builds our lives on a foreseen design. Now here comes the future aspect of karma. This prescient architect knows what each of us must become eventually. So we have to go through those experiences which are not only based on the past. Karma has another aspect, the future. It's not only the past that decides the karma, the future. The same experience will come in a certain way, Jo, which will help us in moving towards the future. So karma has these two things because a prescient, it's not a blind God, is not destiny's architect. If he's blind, he will simply start a law and say, okay, whatever you do, it'll come like that. And everything is all left in the limbo. But no, he has the whole roadmap. And even our least stumblings are foreseen above. That's what Savitri reveals to us. That this is how we will move the journey. And it gives so much hope and so much joy to know that everything in life is a passing phase towards a great event, high prefigured event. A prescient architect of fate and chance who builds our lives on a foreseen design. The meaning knows and consequence of each step and watches the inferior stumbling powers. So even those are allowed because they help in a greater destiny. So we are talking about this, how karma is an evolutionary mechanism, about this story that how the fourth Veda was born. So earlier there were only three Vedas, Rig, Sam and Yajurveda. Athar Veda was not known. And this Veda comes much later. And there are a lot of scholars have talked about it. Is it a Veda? Is it not a Veda? How did it come? All these stories are there. But one legend which is very interesting is that when this Veda was born by the seer, the original Vedas, their pandits, they got very angry and infuriated that how come this cannot be regarded as a Veda? Because there are only three Vedas. How can some mortal creature come and write and you call it a Veda? So they went to Lord Shiva. And then Lord Shiva said, look, Brahma, he explained to them in their own logic. He said, how many heads Brahma has? Four. So if he has spoken the Vedas, how can there be only three Vedas? There must be four Vedas. So I have, of course, my own version of the story, which I'll tell later. So where is the fourth Veda? And then he reveals the story that this man who has brought out the fourth Veda was a demon. Originally, there were four Vedas. But he, as Haygreve, the demon, he drinks away one Veda so that this does not go to the gods. Otherwise, they will become all powerful. So he is a demon. He knows there is something in the Vedas which these people are after. But he doesn't know what to do with it. He cannot understand a jot about it. So he simply eats it up. So nice. If you don't understand anything, keep Shurumindo's book on the bedside, below the pillow. Some understanding will come. I know people really having flight sickness. In flight, suddenly you feel like puking and you know, he didn't know what to do. So like that film, Three Idiots, he thought, I'll turn the plane back complaining. But it is very embarrassing. In a picture, you can do it, but in real life. So finally, he remembered Savitri, took it out and just kept it near. And suddenly everything vanished and he went into a blissful atmosphere. So you see, just holding the book of the Lord, so at least that much can be done. So this demon didn't know what to do, so he ate the Veda. So the fourth Veda disappeared. But he has to recompense. Now he only has to vomit it out. So in his next life, because he had eaten the Vedas, he undergoes a change. Though he has eaten with the wrong motive, he becomes the author of the fourth Veda. and therefore respected, pujaniya, one of the seers. So my version is that Brahma had actually not four but five heads. This is a fact. Brahma had five heads. This is the original part. Where is the fifth Veda? So this is the fifth Veda. Savitri is the fifth Veda. Shiva had taken away the fifth head. Why? Because that head was indicative of the ego. It kept on denying everything that the four heads were revealing. Now Shiva doesn't reconcile. He just cuts it off. Now where is that Veda which can reconcile even the most contrary things as aspects of God? I can't think of any other book except Savitri and the Life Divine. So it's, please don't quote it. This is just my theory. And I think a valid theory based on a sound revelation that Savitri is indeed the fifth Veda. Krishna Prem wrote that in the review. It is a fifth Veda. It is a fifth Veda because Brahma has five heads. And where is the fifth head? So this is the fifth Veda which has come. And for the revelation of this Veda, just like the fifth head, the ego must vanish. And it reveals itself so beautifully. Upon her silent heights, she was aware. So Savitri is aware that even though there are two levels at which she is operating. One outwardly, like an ignorant person walking the road. But upon her height, she is aware. Upon her silent height, she was aware of a calm presence throned above her brows, who saw the goal and chose each fateful curve. This is the difference between the great ones and us ordinary mortals. We want to avoid and escape every battle, every difficulty, every problem. We don't want to undergo the difficulty and, as Shubhendu says, the godlike toil. But great spirits choose it. They don't choose the path of escape. Mother says in one of her prayers, what kind of courage is mine that it is always wanting to escape? She didn't want to, you know, get into all this entangled because she was in such a blissful, complete inner state. She says, no, this is not the true courage. I must face the difficulty and the toil. So we have this, that this calm presence saw the goal and chose each fateful curve. It used the body for its pedestal, the eyes that wandered where its searchlight fires, the hands that held the reins, its living tools. All was the working of an ancient plan, a way proposed by an unerring guide. This guide does not make mistakes. We have our own human notions. So we think, actually good and bad are purely responses of the ego-bound mind. There is nothing essentially good or bad. These are reactions of an ignorant consciousness. Everything moves towards a great prefigured event. So look at life of Socrates. Socrates is being asked to take hemlock and he can escape by simply saying, asking an apology, that's all. He is told that he has to just say that, look, I apologize for having misguided the youth. That's all he has to say. He refuses to say that. Why should Socrates refuse? Somebody else would say, oh, he was foolish. But Socrates is the wisest of the wise. He's very wise. Somebody more practical would say, oh wow, I am given a chance, God's grace. My karma, which was to go to the gallows, suddenly that karma is annulled. It is there in Shurbindo's another aphorism. But for the grace of God, here goes Sir Philip Sidney. And then he comments on that. He says, it is for the grace of God that Sir Philip Sidney goes to the gallows. So how the soul chooses? Socrates chose instead not to apologize, but to state the facts and leave the decision. Now, by doing it, he took hemlock, and Plato later wrote the apology that what Socrates did and why he did it. Because he stood for truth all his life and he wanted to show what is the path of truth. The death of body is nothing. And he left such a wonderful example. So Socrates would have failed in his mission had he survived. But Socrates succeeded in his mission by his death. Just like Jesus Christ. Same we see in Sri Aurobindo. That we cannot understand because we are seeing only the outward. But Savitri knows, who saw the goal and chose each fateful curve. Across wide noons, this is a lovely line, across wide noons and glowing afternoons, the glow of the setting sun. She met with nature and with human forms and listened to the voices of the world. Driven from within, she followed her long road. Always we are driven from within, but we don't understand it. So we are driven seemingly by outside, by nature's blind machinery. Shubhendu says at one another place, all here seems nature's blind machineries, an endless servitude to casual rule and random chance. It looks like that, but it's not the truth. Something inside takes us, even through dangers and disaster, as the spirit's food to grow. Mute, driven from within, she followed her long road. Mute in the luminous cavern of her heart, like a bright cloud through the resplendent day. So Savitri, even though outwardly it looks that events are taking this form, but the avatar knows. He knows why he is going through it. Why Sri Aurobindo would choose to be tied to the waist and taken to the jail? If he is an avatar, he could have just said some mantra, and like he saved so many of us, he could have saved himself. But he doesn't do that. He goes to the jail. This is the beauty. Outward mind raises a question, but his own inner self answers it so beautifully that there is a work to do for which you are here. So this is how the avatar chooses. And again in Valmiki Ramayana, it is shown so beautifully that a time comes in the forest when Rama and Sita decide, now the time has come for the work for which we are here. So they cannot do this work if they remain totally in their full bliss consciousness. So what is to be done? Sita veils herself. It's very beautiful. She becomes avidyamai maya, ignorant. And therefore, the first sign of ignorance is, she tells Rama, what a lovely deer, go after it. Sign of ignorance. And look at Lord Rama. He also knows, but he also veils. Are you sure, Sita? How can there be a golden deer? Think about it. Biology never taught us. He doesn't say, I am the Lord, I know it. It's a daman. He gives a logic. How can? Are you sure? Oh, you want to avoid it? Now, naturally, Rama cannot bear it. So he goes. How much pain, suffering, struggle. If somebody was to question why Rama had to go through all this, they say he is divine. Divine should have known what a mess this is going to create. He simply had to tell Sita, look, Sita, you are making a mistake. I know from my inner vision that this is nothing but Marich. But he doesn't do that. So this is how she knows at one level what she is going to undergo. And yet destiny, she accepts that road of destiny leading her to Satyavan. In the luminous cavern of her heart, she is conscious of the kind of choice that she is making. Now, of course, this consciousness may not be about all the details, but the great difficulty that she must undertake upon herself. Now we have another beautiful passage, next few pages. This is in three parts. First part is about curve of destiny. She's on a quest. The next part is a most beautiful, exquisite description of nature. Again, just like the canto, the symbol dawn. Sri Aurobindo not only makes us nature come alive, he makes us see God in nature. Actually, so many times, at least I am blind, we go and see things, we feel thrilled, but he will make God appear as he leads us through the next couple of pages. And then the various efforts of humanity towards self-exceeding, and finally Savitri, her chosen instrument. At first her path ran through people tracts, admitted to the lion eye of states and theatres of the loud act of man. her carven chariot with its fretted wheels threaded through clamorous marts and sentinel towers, past figured gates and high dream sculptured fronts and gardens hung in the sapphire of the skies, pillared assembly halls with armored guards, small fanes where one calm image washed man's life. Fanes are like small little temples. So we can actually, each line reminds us of something or the other. Babylon, Greece, Rameshwaram, it reminds us of all these places. And she is going through busy streets, towns, loud acts of man, emperors. Would she choose one of them for the great work? No, she passes beyond them. And temples hewn as if by exiled gods to imitate their lost eternity. How beautiful this line is. Exiled gods. This, of course, referring primarily to Greek mythology, where gods were exiled. A lot of gods have been exiled when they didn't obey Zeus. And Zeus was quite a, seems like a arbitrary god who would immediately exile them. In Indian thought also there are exiled gods, especially Indra, who has been exiled from heaven for some misdeeds. And King Nahush, who becomes Indra, that's the famous story. Indra is exiled. So he says, what do I do? How do I come back? Now Nahush has occupied my throne. So sage Agast goes and it's a long story. He wants to marry Sachi. But Sachi can't be married to him. She's married to Indra. And finally, just for the sake of it, Sachi says, okay, you at least come to me in a palki driven by the seven seers, Saptarishi. He is so blinded. He says, okay, I am Indra, king of gods, I order you to take me in the palki. So the Saptarishis come and they are taking him in the palki to Sachi. Very symbolic story. Don't want to go into it. It will take us away from this. But then a time comes when he is full of excitement. He says, go fast, go fast. You people can't go fast. And he uses the word sarpa, sarpa, go fast, fast. And at one point he gets so angry, he pushes Agast with his feet, all in his haughtiness. So, when he is haughty, pride, arrogance, these are the beginnings of downfall. That's why mother says humility is the safeguard. Even if one is an emperor, a sage, a seer, pride and haughtiness and arrogance open the door to a downfall. So, he pushes and Agastrishi, it's all foreseen. He says, sarpa, sarpa, you be a sarpa. So, he becomes a snake, falls down. Becomes a lowly creature creeping. So exiled gods. But then naturally, after all, he is a god of kings. So he builds his own empire. He becomes a king of snakes. Happy that even here I am king. But it's a fallen deity. So exiled gods creating their own, recreating their own lost eternity. Often from gilded dusk to argent dawns, where jewel lamps flickered on frescoed walls and the stone lattice stared at moonlit boughs. Surely this is all experience of the past. Half conscious of the tardy listening night, dimly she glided between banks of sleep. Only the Lord can write like this. Banks of sleep. We don't experience that we move in sleep from one phase to another. But Savitri's is at one level a conscious journey. She is moving between banks of sleep, crossing rivers and going across. At rest in the slumbering palaces of kings, hamlet and village saw the fate wane pass. Homes of a life bent to the soil it ploughs for sustenance of its short and passing days. That transient, keep their old repeated course, unchanging in the circle of a sky which alters not above our mortal will. See how the Lord would have seen all this. The farmer toiling in the soil, what Sri Aurobindo would have thought, how the mother would have felt. Oh, this is human life? as is recounted another place in Savitri, all sprang to their daily unchanging, unvarying acts. People wake up and look at the life of an average person in a village, going to the soil, ploughing the little patch of sky, that's his whole world. How can that be enough? And so he describes, which alters not above our mortal toil, away from this thinking creature's burdened hours, to free and griefless spaces now she turned. So she knows the pain of this kind of life. Even if outwardly there is no pain, still there is no scope, little to evolve. I have a term for this, mohalla mentality. It's of course called as gossip in more dignified way. But in mohalla, you know, there was not this, that time there was no TV and all. And every day, at least we had in our house, one servant boy who would come back for the work, and there would be a few more people, and they will sit and ask, so what happened today? So what happened today was not about big events happening in America, or whether, you know, Aam Aadmi Party has been selected or has resigned. These were not the events. So he would come and narrate with lot of joy in his face. He'll face with light up with a joy that, you know, today, so and so, in that particular mohalla, his bahu scolded him. Oh, is it? Oh, that lady is bad. That's how it is. Then somebody else, his father-in-law or son-in-law, or mother-in-law, some in-law, behaved like this. Somebody slipped on the road. All these little events crowding human life. How small life can become in that patch of land. So sometimes we also end up, you know, talking only about what happened within our mohalla. Our mohalla is, of course, few lanes here. So I use the word mohalla mentality. But this is how human consciousness has been, and it's burdensome. It's a great burden to be stuck to that. And that's why even television is an act of God, despite everything. It has liberated many people in the villages. Now they know what is happening. They know their leaders, they know their ministers. It's good. They are also aspiring, dreaming, even desiring. It's better to desire than to be completely in that inertia. So the Lord has his own ways, but from these burdened places, he goes to free and griefless spaces. In Narada's descent from Vishnu Lok, Vaikuntha, a zone comes where Sri Aurobindo describes that his music and song now assumed a different hue. He no more sang of Vishnu and his births. He sang no more of the immortal's bliss. What he sings? He sings like the famous poet, unfortunately, our sweetest songs are those that tell of the saddest tales. Why should it be? But that's earth. That there is a sweetness in the sorrow, the touch of sorrow in mortal things. So beautifully Nalnida writes about it, how the divine experiences it. It comes with man. It comes not even with man, with the mind. The mother says it has come with mind because it is ignorant and there is a perversity which enters into it. So the moment she leaves behind the human space, immediately she comes to a griefless space. That's why people, you know, when they are in grief, it's very good to go to a place. Of course, best is to come to Pondicherry because it's far beyond humanity and everything else. But otherwise, it's good to go in nature. So after a while, one feels wide. One feels that joy which is inside nature. It's not yet corrupted and polluted. In olden times, even for tuberculosis, this used to be the treatment. And once mother said this, when someone says it's tuberculosis, she said, There is no disease like tuberculosis. Tuberculosis is not a disease. It's a depression of the immune system. It's so true. And tons of medicines are being given. But in olden times, people used to go for a change. My own village, people from Calcutta would come. And they would say, it's a place for changers. So when people from Calcutta came, so we used to say, changers have come. Because they would come for nice, small little place. So they would be very happy in that place for some days. So escape from city life into some such place. And so beautifully it's described in one line. away from this thinking creature's burdened hours to free and griefless spaces now she turned, not yet perturbed by human joys and fears. What pollutes? It's not only the physical pollution, but our excitements, our fears, our hopes, our anxieties, they pollute and they enter into all, they are circulating all around. The mother in one of her early talks, when she formed a little society of just about regular members, were only 3 or 4, she says, and for 1 year she continued meetings. And so whenever people say in our place the study circle hardly 5 or 6 come, so it's very good, because in that only 3 or 4 came with the Divine Mother being there. We cannot imagine that she is in a physical presence and yet just 3 or 4, and they come there. And she speaks at one place on thought, and then she says, the atmosphere of a city like Paris, we would love to go there. And the Divine Mother says, it is full of desires. She doesn't appreciate it. People die, get crazy to go. But here she is saying, it's full of desires. You can't help it. It's enveloping. It's all everywhere around. So very often people ask, what is the difference between ashram and the world? Because everything is here. Yes, but there is a difference. The difference is in the world, also divine is there because he is everywhere. But he is oppressed by the darkness, like Trinavrat, Putna, sitting on the little baby. Ultimately, he'll be victorious. But you have to do a lot of labor to feel, because in a normal course, you are surrounded by desires, those thoughts. But here, all the darkness is oppressed by the divine. There is a pressure for transformation, for change, and that too we can feel consciously, constantly. So that is the difference. The divine enveloping the darkness, and darkness enveloping and covering the divine. But of course, this is a magic land, wonderland. She has created a paradise on earth, as Sishirda once mentioned. And so true, as much today as any other day. But normally, the human consciousness pollutes everything by its inner thoughts. So next time when we walk into the ashram, they have written, please switch off your mobiles. And they are so fussy sometimes, if you tell them that we want to, can we turn it on silent? No, 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 switch it off. I mean, I understand. Many don't know. They are not tech savvy. So they don't understand that it's okay if you turn it on silent. No, please. Really, it doesn't bother anyone. But most important is, please switch off. This is the difficult part, because it's all the time, all kinds of thought. This mobile is all the time, 24/7 active. It's filling the whole courtyard. So every night the gods come and clean the place. This is what Mother has said. Gods come, they have to clean the place of what? Physical cleaning is done by human beings. Gods come to clean all the dirt that we throw there. Amma, you are like this. Amma, you are that. Give me this, give me that. So all those desires are circulating, and obviously divine has better things to attend to, and gods also should not remain jobless. They should also have a job to do. So they are given a job. They also enjoy service of the divine. So why not? So she comes to these spaces, not yet perturbed. Here was the childhood of primeval earth. Here timeless musings, large and glad and still, men had forborne as yet to fill with cares. Imperial acres of the eternal sower. Wow, beautiful. And wind-stirred grasslands winking in the sun. What a line. Grasslands winking in the sun. They just wink. And what a transaction is taking place between earth and heaven. And these are lands not yet touched by humanity. Their griefs, their cares, their anxieties. Or mid green musing of woods and rough browed hills. Oh, that's why the mother says at one place in one of her prayers, she says, I understand why human beings have this need from time to withdraw to the mountains or to the deserts. Because in that solitude, it's so much more easier to come in contact with the divine presence. Nobody is there to disturb us that, okay, fine, enough of meditation. What about tea? What about evening? Or your favorite program is coming. Or there is a newspaper at the doorstep. Bliss. Because these things are not there. Except idea. Mobile. They advertise. I don't know. I hope it's not working. Though I have a friend who climbed Mount Everest and recently in Australia. And from the peak, he sent me a message. A lovely boy. He was here. Yoga Bhyas. And he sent a message. Lovely message from that peak. Alok Da, I have climbed here with mother's flag. So it was such a joy to hear that with mother's flag, somebody has climbed to the highest peak. He has climbed four highest peaks in four continents. Mount Everest also, he carried mother's flag. But that's a good use of the mobile. But we won't use it like that. We would go there and after reaching Mount Everest, we will get photographs and immediately SMS and then phone calls and everything. Hurry, enjoy for some time the company of Lord Shiva. So here it is. She is describing those spaces that are past the long lapsing voice of silver floods. Just imagine walking through a stream and to feel the music of that stream, which increases as we come near, and as we walk past, it begins to lapse slowly. It's like a music. It's amazing how the Lord is experiencing these things. Like a swift hope journeying among its dreams, hastened the chariot of the golden bright. One of out of the world's immense, unhuman past, tracked memories and ageless remnants came. There also she has memories. Mother describes at one place the memories of first humanity. And she says, we were there. I have a distinct memory. And then she says, she's trying to recollect, was it on the left side or the right side? She says, I have a memory of the first humanity which sprang out of the animal kind. And it was very, very early humanity, totally in harmony with nature. Very beautiful humanity. But then mind developed and it was like a fall. So she says the biblical story of the fall is about that sudden development of the mind and that it's like a paradise lost. That's why we have stories like Shangri-La which try to capture that. So there also she remembers those past things. As we said, she was probably in Kashmir practicing some kind of a mystic yoga in some cave. Domains of light and theft to antique calm. Wow. Listen to the unaccustomed sound of youths. Now they're getting disturbed. Who is this coming? The golden bride, the sound of hooves. They've never heard this. And large, immune, entangled silences. What a line this is. Silences which nothing can touch. Entangled mid nature, woven through the lattices of nature, through the play of light and shade in the forest. That silence which is running through all the haze and maze in a forest. What beautiful this is. Absorbed her into emerald secrecy and slow hushed wizard nets of fiery bloom. What would be those fiery blooms at one place to other day I was reading and I was so touched. Mother looks at a rose with a fiery color, almost like fire. And she remarks to the disciple, it is difficult for nature to make this kind of a thing again. So beautiful, something so perfect, so remarkable. So looking at nature like that and how mother used to appreciate every small thing like that with so much of detail and depth. Environed with their colored snare, her wheels, the strong importunate feet of time fell soft. Look at its what lines. Environed with their colored snare, her wheels. Look, golden bride, stay in our midst. Stay for a few days. This, we have created this wonderful space for you. It is again described in Ramayana as Rama and Sita moved through the forest. The different spaces will tell them, stay for a few while here. We want you to be here. It's only man that says, why have you come? But nature welcomes. The strong, importunate feet of time fell soft. Importunate. Time runs fast. It is always in a hurry. That's why it is time, every second. But suddenly it looked like time has slowed down. It's falling softly. Everything has slowed down. Along these lonely ways, his titan pace forgotten and his dark and ruinous rounds, the inner ear that listens to solitude, leaning self-wrapped, unboundedly could hear the rhythms of the intenser wordless thought that gathers in the silence behind life. How beautifully Sri Aurobindo reveals this truth again in one of his stories, that there is a silence behind life, and Krishna, he calls us from there. But even the first notes as they enter our consciousness, our mind and life and body, they grab at it and make it wear its own hue and shade. And then he says, why does Krishna allow it? Because they too have to change. So he allows it. Let them grab it. Give its own color. After all, in any ways, any which way, they are picking up that one note of that flute. But he says, but if we want to really hear the flute, we must go behind the noise of life and catch that silence that is behind life. Of course, this is possible in a city. It's a state of consciousness, but much more difficult. And the mother has experienced it from childhood several times. And the way is, the method that Sri Aurobindo and the mother have given is, and Sri Aurobindo himself experienced, it's there in one of his poems, where the city suddenly vanishes, floats like a cinema screen, quivers and vanishes. So similarly, instead of focusing on the noise and the sounds and the constant reactions and responses, if for a while we just let all this pass, then suddenly all the meaningful words begin to change into just sound. And after a while we pass beyond the sounds and we begin to touch something that is there in the silent depths of that noise. How beautifully this is, and how human problems can be resolved. Imagine if two people are fighting and one person says, okay, I'll listen to the sound, silence behind these sounds. So minimum he will do is he will not speak. And that will resolve all the problems. Just one person should not speak and every problem is resolved. But to listen to that silence behind life. In olden days, they used to do it by withdrawing to such spaces. But today, divine wants an integral yoga. So no such solitary space is left. Not even Mount Everest. You will find a can of Coca-Cola for sure there. So now one has to contact that silence. And the low, sweet, inarticulate voice of earth in the great passion of her sun-kissed trance. What beautiful line this is. Sun-kissed trance. Every day morning when the sun comes, he kisses the earth to wake it up. And earth begins to smile. So when it smiles, blooms come out of it. That's earth's expression of returning that love. Sun-kissed. Sweet inarticulate voice of earth in the great passion of her sun-kissed trance ascended with its yearning undertone afar from the brute noise of clamorous needs. The quieted all-seeking mind could feel at rest from its blind outwardness of will the unwearied clasp of her mute patient love and know for a soul the mother of her forms. That nature, mother nature, has given form to all this. She's so full of love, so full of patience. But to capture that mood of nature, to capture that stillness, we have to go behind the noise and tramp of life. And this she says even in one of her talks on an aphorism. She says, to balance the speed of life, we need monasteries and ashrams. So that for some time one can go there and feel the quietude, that atmosphere. That was the purpose, to balance the need and speed of life. So we'll stop here, continue tomorrow.